it seems, to have a dream, to open and run a bakery. But they took a chance, took the sweets to the street. Now they all have places where I'd love to eat.
Hello there, bakeroos and bakerettes. Welcome to the Rise Up Podcast. I'm your host, Mark Dick, and this is the show about bakers and bakeries and bakery owners and all the folks that work so hard, often through the night, to make the good stuff and share it with the people in their communities. How are you this week? We're back. Wow. So cool to be back. So cool to be talking to you once again. That was a long break. I've been off traveling, as you may know. Cindy and I were out in the UK, all through England and Scotland, to visit our kids who for some reason both live over there. And it was a good adventure. It was a lot of fun. We traveled in a clockwise direction, roughly, or maybe more of a figure eight, from London up to Liverpool and Chester and Port Sunlight, and then over to Edinburgh, and then to Glasgow, and then south to York and out to Kent on the southeast coast, and then back to London and then home. And that was summer, in a nutshell. A lot of train travel, a lot of public transportation, and it was lovely. It really struck me after we got home, after a month of riding trains and the odd bus and motor coach all around the UK, and very easily, it's like, you know, hourly expresses between Edinburgh and Glasgow, and, you know, multiple trains a day across the whole breadth of the country. And then to come home, and I'm trying to get back home to Saskatchewan quicker than normal because my dad needs some help. And I don't own a car. And I live on Vancouver Island on the West Coast. And I need to get back to the prairies. And I'm telling you, it is impossible. These days, it is impossible to get from where I live to the middle of the country with public transportation unless you take an airplane. That's the only way. And flights seem to be crazy. It's $1,000 to get a ticket from Victoria to Regina, which is insane. And then I could rent a car, but there are no cars to be had. And the ones that are there, it's more like $900 a week to rent a car. So it's the last couple of years has been pretty wild, a bit of a wake-up call. It seems the answer is buy your own car and pay for the gas and stuff. I would sure love a train line cross country. That would help me out a lot because train travel is the best, I have to say. And people in the UK, they complain a lot about train travel because the trains aren't as good as they used to be and the prices have gone up and they've been privatized and all this. But I'll tell you, there is something sweet about going to the middle of the city, going to a grand old train station, getting on the train and setting off cross country and seeing the sights and having a good sit and just looking out the window for a couple hours. It's brilliant. I'm a huge fan. Oh, hey, today's show, I forgot to mention. I talk with Elizabeth the Rough today. She's awesome. She is part of Honoray Farm and Mill in Marin County, California, or Marin. I'm not exactly sure. But, you know, north of San Francisco, across the Golden Gate, where it's really nice, that's Marin County. I'll call it Marin for now. That's where the farm and mill is, and she's got a really interesting story. But I'm going to talk about this England trip a little bit more, maybe from a baking perspective. How's that? We'll go baking, then family. Baking perspective, it was great. There were so many decent bakeries that we went to along the way, on the high street, off the high street, some really cool places. I got to see my friend Phil from Haxby Bakehouse in Haxby, which is just north of York. When we were there, and that was nice. We've only swapped emails before and, you know, kind of follow each other on Instagram, or I follow him. I won't be presumptuous and say he follows me, but, always liked what he did. And Sheena Howdle, who was on the show a few years ago, worked with Phil out in York or Haxby. And, we finally got to meet face to face and we visited the bakery and it was great. It was so nice. Visited his retail shop. He's got a bigger production facility that he just moved to. We went out and took a look at that, met the bakers. That was way cool. A lot of fun. And I hope to get Phil on the show to have a proper visit that I can share with you all. He's just a really busy guy And so we're going to try and figure something out there. And then when we were out to see Robin, our daughter out in Kent, we went to the seaside village of Whitstable. And there's a bakery there called Grain and Hearth that one of Robin's coworkers, his husband, works the front at Grain and Hearth. And so set up a bakery visit there, and we went and ate like kings and then toured the bakery and stuff. And it was so much fun. And the cool thing about that is that when the last time we were out to England before COVID, my buddy Arlo in Michigan said, "Hey, if you're heading out that way, you should go to Whitstable and go to Grain and Hearth." And we didn't make it out there on that trip. But now 2.5 years later, we made it out, and it was well worth it. I never got to meet the actual owner and baker of that bakery because he was away on vacation. But I met the bake crew and met the front staff and met David, who's, you know, Sam's husband that works there and kind of does an awful lot in the front. And we had a really good time. Impeccable baked goods as well at both spots. And there were more. I'm going to try and get some guests based on the places that we saw while we were in the UK for the weeks ahead. And so we can share some conversations. And there were some places that I missed, and I feel bad that I missed, but you know, you can't get everywhere. It was just one of those things. I think our eyes were bigger than our itinerary for that trip. So hopefully next time, or who knows, I'm trying to watch my environmental footprint and also my wallet, but I would dearly love to go back there soon and see everyone again. Not least of which for the reason that, you know, both of our kids are out there, and it was just lovely to spend long periods of time with them again. I miss that. I found the biggest thing, you know, that I miss is not being in the same time zone as the kids, because my kids are, they're adults now, right? Our kids are 27 and 25. They're adults. They're living their own lives. They're starting their careers, but it's nice to be around them close by when they need help, or just to talk with and not have to calculate 8 hours of time zones to make that work and to have an evening conversation first thing in our morning because it's evening in the UK or that kind of a thing. So it was really nice. And we spent about 8 or 9 days with Ben up in Glasgow and 8 or 9 days with Robin in York. She came up to York and then we went down to Broadstairs where she lives. And then she even spent a couple days in London with us before we flew home. So that was nice. It was really, really good. I'm recharged because of that. There's something about family that recharges you. All right, enough of my talking. Let's get on to the conversation with Elizabeth DeRuff. So we've got some really interesting stuff going on here at Honoré Farm and Mill. They are a very small farm and mill and education facility and seminar provider and all kinds of things. And they do it on a very, very small scale. And they do it for a specific reason. And it's really about, I think it's about bringing people to the land to understand where their food comes from. And Elizabeth is going to talk a lot about that. And I'm going to learn a lot about it from her because when I first heard about the farm is when she reached out to me to say, "Hey, back in the spring, we're taking off our first major harvest of an old heritage grain called Haruni, which I think I mistakenly call halloumi a couple of times in our conversation, and I apologize for that right now. Halloumi being a Cypriot cheese that is extremely popular in the UK, and you see it all over the place. And 2 days after we got back from the UK is when I talked to Elizabeth, and I had halloumi on the brain. So it's not called halloumi, it's harani. And it's an ancient strain of wheat that actually is from Palestine and was rediscovered, or a cache of it was rediscovered in some ruins in the deserts around Palestine. And Elizabeth talks about that and the origins of this grain as well. But they've been growing it out for 4 years now and are taking off some significant amounts of this grain now from the different plots of land that they have around Marin County. And if you're listening to this on the day of release on Wednesday the 24th. They are actually doing a harvest and having a harvest event this coming weekend on the 27th. And so check the show notes here. There will be a link to the Honoré Farm and Mill site. And if you're in the neighborhood and you want to make the trip out there to be part of this harvest and to check out this unique variety of wheat, check the show notes and you can reach out and hopefully make it over there. And if not this year, go next year, okay? Because they're going to keep on doing this. All right, here's the talk with Elizabeth Deruff from Honoré Farm and Mill in Marin County, California. Yeah, this has been a long time coming. I'm glad we're finally able to get together here. This is great.
Me too. Yeah. And you've been traveling a lot, haven't you?
Yeah, I just got back. Both of our kids ended up in the UK, oddly enough. And so if you want to go visit, you got to get on a plane these days. Yeah, it was a good trip. It was a long trip though. So yeah, we just got back on Friday. So how's your harvest season going here?
Well, today we have four fields and we have one harvested. That was a great harvest because we didn't expect it. It was our first acre of sort of production Harani grain that we're growing up in Clear Lake. And we have been farming with a professional farmer. And we put 100 pounds in and we got 3,200 pounds out last year.
Nice.
Pretty remarkable yield for 100 pounds. And then the land was untouched all year. The grain reseeded itself, complete volunteer. And so we just got another 1,000 pounds of that same acre, the exact same footprint. So
how nice.
Excited about that. It's the same protein level. We're low moisture, so it's got great baking characteristics. But today is kind of a weird day. There were passing thunderstorms, and we have three fields. And tomorrow we're scheduled to harvest in Sebastopol. And I've been actually texting with the farmer who's bringing his combine over. We're talking about maybe even going this afternoon. It just feels very vulnerable right now. We're having strange weather, like it was in the 90s yesterday and then super cold this morning and kind of thunderstorms. So,
do you just straight combine? Like you're not swathing at first, right?
No, we're not.
Yeah, well, see, because I guess my grandparents and my dad farmed grain in Saskatchewan, right? Like that's growing up and stuff. And it was the old school where you swathed at first, and then it would rain and snow, and they'd fret and fume, and you know that kind of thing, right? And so you need rain when you need it, and now is not the time for sure.
Right. That's right.
Yeah. Meanwhile, I'm assuming everyone around you that isn't into grain farming would be like, oh, thank goodness there's some rain, because I hear it's been kind of dry in California, but.
I'm all for rain, just not a few days before harvest.
Yeah. Three more days. Yeah. Oh, so cool. Well, and I've been reading up on the sort of, I'll call it the project, because you've got so many different things going on. I'm really curious to know sort of like what the big picture of the farm and mill project that you're doing, and then what the heck got you into this?
Well, maybe I'll begin with what got me into it. It was like 20 years ago, and I was serving as the dean and chaplain of a family camp up on a ranch up in Healdsburg. And the first day that I was overseeing this group of about 120 people, we would have just a great, you know, sort of a service every morning. Everybody came in their swimsuits and we would act out different stories. And then there was communion. So this was 2003. So pretty much 20 years ago. And a woman said to me, she whispered in my ear, "I'm allergic to bread." That was 2003. So I'd never heard the word gluten before. I didn't know what a celiac was. That was not part of the, you know, parlance of that time. And so it kind of just lodged in my mind like, huh, allergic to bread. Wow. And then, you know, as time went on, more and more people became, you know, intolerant to wheat and gluten, and there's lots of different ideas about why that might be. Then I started working on an agricultural project, and I met this grain farmer in my area, and he said he was growing these old heirloom grains that people with gluten issues could actually tolerate and digest easily. And I just, it made me curious, how could there be wheat that people are allergic to and wheat that people aren't allergic to? And it just captivated my curiosity. And I just took a huge deep dive, and I felt like I just couldn't learn enough. I took university classes, I took farming classes, I went to, you know, conferences, seminars, called people, read books. And the more I learned, the more interested I became.
Yeah. Yeah. And so you really came at it from the sort of the health aspect, and then getting into the different varieties, as opposed to all, you know, sort of the conventional blends and that kind of thing.
Well, and if we look back in time, you know, wheat has sustained civilization for millennia. So why isn't it today? You know, what's different about it? And that's really interesting. There are really discrete differences. And then I started, someone asked me to teach a class at one of our local public schools. So, and that was in Marin City. And so I had never planted wheat before. And I'm like, okay, we're going to learn how to plant wheat. And it was during that with the kids, like in the fall, we actually planted the seeds. And actually, no, excuse me, it was in the spring. And we went through every week we met on a Wednesday. So I called it Wheat Wednesdays. And I made a lesson out of each week, and we measured it. And I realized they didn't know what an inch was. They didn't know what unit of measurement was. This was a really underserved school. So everyone got measuring tapes, and they're measuring everything in the garden. And then in the fall, we got back together, and I taught them how to hand harvest with a sickle and how to thresh and mill. And then we baked cookies with the grain that we harvested. And it was really when, because I kept asking them this one question. So how does a grain of wheat become a loaf of bread? No one could answer that question. And I just, it was all through sort of a pedagogy of inquiry. You know, I just kept asking the question. And finally, when they put the grains, we had a corn, like a mill with a handle on it. And the kids put the seeds in the hopper, and the flour came out. They're like, flour, of course, that's how you make bread. And it was the milling that, you know, kind of demystified the whole process. And I realized there were no mills in this area. So we did a Kickstarter campaign in 2016. And then that's when Honore Farm and Mill was incorporated as a 501c3 nonprofit. And we did this Kickstarter and raised money to build a traveling mobile mill house.
Oh, cool. Yeah. Yeah. And I was checking that out on your website too, which sounds really awesome. You know, like I've talked to a few folks around, well, North America anyways, that have kind of done that from a teaching perspective, right? Like you've got to almost get the mill out in front of people and see it, because it's just not, well, it's like any, where does your food come from, right? You know, folks just don't know that anymore. Get it right out in front of them.
Most people, I mean, I usually ask people, have you ever milled flour before? And I have very few people have ever said yes. And I've
taken
conferences with thousands of people. So we've got a lot of data.
Oh, yeah. Well, goodness, you know, there's an awful lot of bakers that I know, and myself included, that like I never milled flour at my own bakery. You know, I'd go talk to the millers and stuff, but it was after the fact that I worked with some folks that milled on site and stuff, and it's a whole other world for sure.
Do you mill your own grain or no?
I don't. I know my people, and I'm buying straight from, kind of a thing. But I took a class, well, with some of the folks that you know were there as well, like from the Grain Lab and that kind of thing, in Rhode Island in 2018, where we milled the night before, baked the next day, and that was pretty transformative. The single origin or the discrete varieties of wheat baking with them, and the flavor profiles of the fresh flour and stuff was very eye-opening for me back in 2018. Yeah.
You could really taste the difference.
Oh, goodness, yes. Oh, yeah.
The dough, you could really feel the difference.
Yeah. Well, because I baked a lot with spelt flour at our bakery in Saskatchewan, and then working with some of the specific varieties that Jim Williams was using in Rhode Island, was like, oh, okay, that's a whole other level of flavor kind of a thing. I went to a seminar with the folks from the Bread Lab in Washington State that were at Wheatstock there, and just talking about finding varieties that work for the specific locales when you're not Kansas or you're not Saskatchewan, where I'm from, and that it can be actually an advantage because you get to work with grains that are designed or have evolved, I guess more than designed, have evolved for that locale. And then you get the flavor and you get the yield because it's a proper fit, as opposed to taking stuff that works great in Saskatchewan and trying to force it everywhere else. Right. So yeah, that flip for me was pretty wild. It's several more layers than talking to the folks in Saskatchewan that say we're doing organic farming or we're trying to do, you know, grow ancient grains and that kind of thing. And just seeing the level of tuning that folks are doing now, you know, and really digging in. So, which is kind of, I think, is sort of the story of the new old wheat that you're growing, right? It's kind of like it's a variety I've not heard of before, and is, if it's not unique to yours, it's pretty niche down to, you know, what you're doing.
Mm-hmm.
How did you go from teaching to okay, we're going to actually start a farm? I guess what's the goals from the farm and mill perspective now? Is it still education or is there more as well?
Yeah, I mean, I think the mission of it is broader. I think it's reconnecting people with the relationship with the land, from where our food comes from. And we do that, strengthening that relationship. We do that through the cultivation of heritage grains, and then through hands-on education, and through sort of employing traditional farming practices. So there's a whole culture around food and connection to the land. And I think, you know, the more we understand what regeneration is, you know, regenerative organic farming, and the soil's capacity for regeneration, to me, it's the connection of the regenerative capacities within us, generative capacities within the soil. And what is that dialogue? And how can we discover that and strengthen that in with everyone who partakes in that?
Right, right. Does it sort of manifest by trying to get as many people as possible sort of out to the farm?
So we began, so after I taught in Marin City, I just bought flour from a mill about 2 hours from here. And I just asked my friends who wanted to try it. And there was some demand, not a lot. That was probably actually 2014. And I mean, I think maybe I sold 200 pounds of flour, you know, 2 pound bags of flour, so maybe 100 bags of grain. And then I had this idea, like, what happens if we bring people together and we just start planting it and have a planting, you know, day, and then we have a harvest ritual? So we started doing that. This is our eighth year, and the eighth time we'll have done that is coming up on August 27th, and we're doing it in Petaluma. And we've always done it on parcels of land that have been donated to us for that purpose. And so there are many different ways in which we enact our mission. Some of it is straight up education at schools. I've done online classes. I've done in-person classes. We've planted grain in schools. It's bringing people up to the farms for planting, tending, and harvest days. We've taken our mobile mill to conferences. We make a very wicked awesome shortbread cookie out of two different varieties of wheat. And I feel like that's sort of a calling card. Like, you taste that and it's like, that is a really different shortbread cookie. And why is that? And we have our story on the box that we sell it in. So hopefully we're introducing this idea and sort of piquing people's interest in understanding what has happened with wheat.
Mm-hmm.
And why is it why can we eat some wheat and not others?
Right, right. And so I guess from sort of 2014 to now, like how's it grown for you in terms of, well, or maybe, and maybe, okay, you can correct me if I'm wrong here, but it's my assumption, which I should validate, is it's that multiplicative effect, right? It's like, okay, I started with one field, now I've planted 100 pounds, I've got now 4,200 pounds off of it. And so is it trying to put more in production? Is it trying to just have enough fields for the people that are coming so they can all participate? I'm curious sort of how you frame the scope of the operation for you.
Right. Well, I'll tell you the story of how, what there's a couple of important sort of turning points. I went from purchasing wheat from this miller and then selling the flour. And those were varieties like Red Fife, Sonora, Corazon, et cetera. And then 4 years ago, Steve Lyon from the Bread Lab at Washington State University, unsolicited, I got a box in the mail and there were four varieties of wheat and four half baggies of grain. And they all looked different. They were different colors. They were different shapes. And we put those all in the ground. And one of them just has this really remarkable story and lineage. And it just captivated my attention and everyone who's been around it. And we actually had to grow it. So we took that half baggie. And then the first year we got 13 pounds. Next year so it's all hand planted, hand harvested. The next year we put 13 pounds in and we got 150 pounds. And that was last year when we took 100 pounds of that and put it in the 1 acre, and we saved 50 pounds in case of emergency. And that's where we got the 3,200 pounds. And then from the 3,200, we began selling to some bakeries. And now we sell to a Michelin rated restaurant, and we've signed a letter of intent to a couple of public school districts in California to begin to supply flour and education to the schools. But the way in which it has multiplied has been fantastic. So we took, 800 pounds or something and put it back in the ground. And so we have about 6.5 acres this year in the ground. And that first 1,000 we've already got out, and then we've got two larger fields, and then we always have our small plot. And so I think that at first it was buying other people's flour and selling it. And now we realize through this educational process, it's really, I mean, Steve Lyon doesn't do it any differently. I mean, he starts by going to the USDA, getting the seeds, putting them in the greenhouse, growing out, 5 grams of seed, and then it propagates from there. And there's really no way to grow these old heirloom varieties except through hand planting and harvesting. It's just too small. So we realize we kind of have this unique opportunity to really look in the providence of other grain varieties. So this year we've got two other fairly rare varieties in the ground in addition to the Harani. So it wasn't until the second year that I even tasted the Harani.
Sure. Oh, yeah.
Tasted it. And when I did taste it, it was pretty profound. It's a pretty remarkable grain. And then this year we have Jaljuli, which was also found. So Harani and Jaljuli were both found at the Masada Fortress, which was archaeological site that was excavated in the 60s, but the grains were buried in the year 73 CE. So, and then we also have another variety called Karun, which is named after one of the rivers in Iraq, the Karun River, which are historically, historians and believe that this is the Garden of Eden.
Oh.
So
cool.
They all have interesting stories and backgrounds, and they all taste so different and behave differently. And I haven't tasted Jaljuli yet. We just started with our half baggie, so it'll be a couple of years.
Yeah. Well, and that's the thing I remember from the Stephen Jones presentation that he gave out in Rhode Island there, is just that getting your head around, like, this is like a sort of a 7-year journey, or it can be, to start growing something out from a few seeds and the trials and then finding the right home for it and all of that. So it's a while before you taste it. And well, and I'm glad you mentioned the cookies, because that's the other thing that kind of I continually have to beat into my head, is that one of the things that he was teaching in that seminar was the grain can be awesome and it can have awesome eating properties, but it doesn't make it always perfect for bread. Sometimes it's good for cookies. Sometimes it's good for brewing. Sometimes it's good for something else, right? And so it's also, it's finding the land and that matches up with the grain, and then finding the, well, the market or the product or the thing that's the best fit as well. So yeah, so cool. Right.
So far with the Harani, I have baked cakes, I've made cookies, brownies, pasta, pizza, bread. So far, we've a really high protein, and just the baking characteristics of it. It's a Durham wheat, and it mills, it's so hard, but it mills very silky smooth. So it's so beautiful to bake into bread. And it was really fun. We sold the flour just as a test in May to 5 different Bay Area bakeries. And it was so fun to taste 5 different. And then we had a Harani tasting party, and the bakers brought their breads and we tasted them and heard from the bakers directly. And so here's this one variety, but it tasted so different depending on who was baking it.
Totally. Oh, yeah.
So beautiful.
Yeah. And that's the other bit of magic, right? Just seeing what the different bakers and the different cooks can do with it is pretty cool. I was talking with a friend of mine just yesterday about exactly that you give 6 good bakers the same ingredients and the same recipe, and you're still going to get 6 different products out the end. So cool. Oh, that's great to hear. And it sounds now that you're sort of finishing up year 2, getting into year 3 with Harani anyways, is that you're...
No, we're finishing up. This will be harvesting year 4.
Year 4, even mm-hmm. better, right? So like it's starting to get where it can start getting out more and more into the world.
Yeah. Although, you know, it, like everyone in the small grain economy, we are very bounded by infrastructure. That's sort of the bottleneck. In addition to growing out these old varieties, you know, our mill is 2 hours away. I mean, I can't even describe to you how we're going to go to Sebastopol to harvest tomorrow. And then I know this other farmer who's driving north, and he's going to take the totes up to the cleaning facility, and then it has to come back to the mill, and then it has to come back to me. I mean, it's very, very labor intensive.
Yeah. Yeah. Until that sort of infrastructure comes back at a closer scale, you know, it's my entire life. It's been about moving things further apart. And now the wave is bringing everything closer together, right? Like, you know, where I grew up, you know, my grandfather would, you take the grain into the elevator, and that's where he sells it. And the elevators were 7 miles apart. Every town was 7 miles apart. And that's where it was. And then all the elevators have gone away, and now they have inland terminals that are 100 miles apart, kind of a thing, right? And it's like you're talking about, let's get it back to less than 7 miles apart.
Well, especially freshly milled flour, you know, it's coffee or pepper. The minute it's milled, it's so fragrant and much more nutritious, hasn't oxidized yet, and it bakes differently. So fresh milling is really important for flavor and nutrition.
Mm-hmm. What's your hope, I guess, for this year for you with the harvest? Is it like, how long is your harvest season going to be? Hopefully like just a couple of days, or are you trying, is it take longer with what you're doing now?
Well, we're a little bit bounded to when we plant on our small propagation fields where we actually host these harvest planting and harvest days. You know, there's so many people that have to be there for the harvest, you know, board members and musicians that I know, and, you know, is it good for the field owner, et cetera. So we pick that date way in the future, and we just try to make sure the grain will be truly, really dry. So we're probably overshooting it this year. The grain is probably ready to be harvested right now, but it's going to be about another week and a half. But the one in Clear Lake, you know, that happened at the end of July. And then we have another, our largest field in Siskiyou. you know, that's quite a bit north. It's right on the Oregon border. And he didn't plant until May.
Right.
So that may go into September. So it depends on the where it's growing.
Yeah. So you're that far afield then with where you're planting, hey?
Well, it's really finding the right farmers
that
are interested in cultivating these grains for us. And it's about those relationships.
Totally. Yeah. Yeah. I remember I talked a couple of years ago with a woman in Northern California, like further north from you, that same kind of a thing was we had a really tight relationship with a local farmer to plant for her. And then she was trying to take enough that she could bake with, and then finding other people to take more so that it was sustainable for the farmer as well.
Mm-hmm.
Well, and then I just in the last six months, anyways, I talked with a fella in Quincy, which is north of you as well. Right. And he's designing his own mills. He's rebuilding these French mills and stuff. Do you know Kyle?
Maybe, you know, I've heard of a new mill, right, in California, but in Quincy, there is Roger Jansen. And actually we have one of his mills in our mobile mill house, and he is a gem of a human being. He's probably 90 now.
Oh, okay. Yeah. No, this is a younger fellow. His name's Kyle, and it's Panarchy. Mills is the name of his thing. And his story that I remember was he was over in Europe and was learning this mill design over there, and then got the rights to rebuild these mills to that design in North America now. And so he's starting that up this year. So it's neat because you need lots of them. Like you say, you need lots of them all over closer to where the people are, for sure.
Absolutely. Now, since I've started, you know, really the last 10 years, there are more farmers. There's one more miller in our areas and others too. I mean, it's incremental, but these are huge commitments by people to take up, and it's, you know, we're really working against the stream of, you know, big food, big ag.
Oh, totally. It's you're even working against medium ag. It's like it's a whole other world. I saw on your bio that you went to the San Francisco Baking Institute, and I did as well. And I remember there was one class that I took, and there was a fellow there from General Mills, and he was like a regional sales guy for General Mills. And the nicest guy you're ever going to meet, and was seriously into the craft and all of that. And you realize we're in two completely different worlds here. You know, I think acceptance of that took me a while. It was just sort of, it's like, we just are. And even the millers that I was buying from were totally off of his radar, you know, just from scale and stuff. It's a different world.
Right. Different ecosystems.
Yeah, you're playing a different game completely.
Mm-hmm. Completely. Mm-hmm.
So yeah, and that's right. I never considered that with the educational aspect of what you're doing, it's like it's built around events. I'm doing a harvest event, and I've got people out, and you can't say it's 2 o'clock, the sun's out, rain's coming, it's ready, let's get it off, right?
Well, in California, we've been, you know, traditionally, we have not had rain in the summers. So it's a pretty, you know, getting a few drops this morning, a little nerve wracking. And actually, the year that we harvested the 150 pounds of Harani, it was August 15th, and 3 years ago. And that night, the huge fire started because we had the electrical, you know, storm and rain. And I remember I could hear rain hitting the roof that night, and we had all of the wheat out in the field because we put it on the small scale. We put it through, we harvest it, and then we put it through bundle threshers, and then we get it cleaned more fully at the granary. And we hadn't had a chance to bundle thresh it, so it was all just out in tarps. We're like, oh, it's going to dry. And that was such a tough morning, waking up and knowing all that grain was exposed. And, some friends that had come to the harvest who come from a grain growing background in the East Coast, I remember they called me that morning. They're like, okay, Elizabeth, we'll meet you at the farm at about 11. We're going to come up and help you. They knew.
Oh, yeah.
And it was just, we worked all day long. It was like 105 degrees, spreading it out in the sun to dry and then bundling it back up and protecting it.
Oh yeah. And that's, you're bringing back memories on a slightly larger scale, but not that much from my dad, right? Like, because you'd get years where it would snow, you'd have everything knocked down and then you'd get some snow and then hopefully it would dry out enough that, you know, he could get it up. And then if you did, if you got yours up, then immediately your phone and the neighbors, like, who needs a hand? And away you go. Cause everyone's trying to get to go hard in those at the same time. Right. And,
right.
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, eventually, I mean, our sort of goal of where we're headed is to start something called a care farm, where it would be an educational farm dedicated to grains. But if we're going to be farming regeneratively, we're obviously going to be growing other crops. And depending upon the permitting, we would like to have animals as well. Not a huge farm. We want it to be near people. And the idea of a care farm actually comes from England. On a trip that I took there, and it uses all or part of a farm to address the needs of a vulnerable constituency in our society. So it's really land-based mental, emotional, physical therapy. And so we've been talking with other nonprofits to partner with, and we've been looking at parcels of land. And so hopefully there we would be buying a bigger mill, have grain storage. We're never going to be growing a lot of grain close to the Bay Area. The land's just too expensive. But the grain can be cleaned and then brought and stored on site. So that care farm is really something that has lit a fire, I think, in myself and everyone on my board. And
it seems to me that's sort of the end game or the goal, really, for a lot of the small scale producers that I've talked to, is just to say, all right, you know, I have X number of acres of land and how many people in my community can this feed, right? And then, in a sustainable way, right? And it can grow over time as your land improves and as your practices improve, but there's a ceiling. Like, you're never putting it on ships and sending it away. It's like, you know, it's the people in the community. And that's one of the things that I think, I don't know. I just think folks need to be talking more about, to say, like, look at, you know, this is designed for X number of people, right? And then when it's working and when we're proving that it's working, then you go and you do another one. You don't just make this one three times bigger, mm-hmm. you know, and that's how it's going to be sustainable around the world. So,
well, I think as a background to what you're saying and sort of what's running through my mind is, you know, we have employed a mechanistic model, which is sort of the model in which there's commodification and there's everything is the same and year after year and, you know, efficiency, profitability, yield, all of that is maximized. So the mechanistic model, the problem that works fine when you're building a car, but I think where it breaks down is when you overlay a mechanistic model onto the living world.
Mm-hmm. Oh, yeah.
Systems do not respond well to maximizing yield. Other things start to fall apart, right? And so I think in the background of what you're saying is, you know, you have X amount of land, and how do we cultivate that land in a way that really regenerates everyone in that ecosystem? The people, the plants, the insects, the land itself, the water, you know, how do we work in concert with that life-giving force?
And it's never been just grow one thing.
Right. There's such a vulnerability in doing that.
Totally. Totally. It's so fragile and so brittle when you do that. Yeah. I remember a story I read about Joel Salatin, the chicken farmer on the East Coast of the States, that,
I've, you know, met him.
Yeah. Oh, have you? Oh, good for you. He's a hero of mine from afar. And in one of his books, he was talking about getting the head of Whole Foods out to see the farm and see the chickens and stuff. And he's like, great, you know, I'd love to order, you know, 100,000 pounds of chicken wings. And he's like, no, it's a whole chicken. Like, you know, you're taking a whole chicken here, right? And when it comes to like grain and that, it's like you said it, you can't just be growing that same variety as the only thing that grows on that piece of land year over year over year. It's not sustainable. So, and that's that's always almost the biggest bit of education I find for folks, is that it's like, because we're so used to ordering infinite quantities of the one thing we want, you know, and it's sort of like, and it's retraining ourselves to say, okay, this land is going to produce this bounty, this variety over an, you know, a multi-year cycle. How do we interact with it and get the benefits from it? But it's going to be different every season, every year, that kind of thing. Yeah.
And that's challenging for bakers.
Oh yeah.
Really challenging. And I empathize a lot with that. Like if you've got, you know, grain that's coming and the protein isn't great or baking characteristics are not fabulous, you know, that's hard for a baker. It's not a perfect model, right? It's something that we, you know, how do we adapt?
Yeah. Well, and you're kind of training or everyone in the chain is learning, right? From customers, from the bakers, from the millers themselves, because it's going to be different from the farmers all the way through. It's dealing with the variability that I think folks have always dealt with, but in this tight period of industrialized time, we kind of got trained. The goal is to eliminate all of that, right?
And I think that's where a lot of the creativity comes from. I mean, the breads of the world, and you know, flatbread. That's probably a reflection of the kind of grain that was growing there. It wasn't going to make a great big puffy loaf, right?
Yeah, exactly.
So I think that's part of the culture and part of the creativity and the responsiveness to our environment. That's really beautiful.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, and I was also reading a little bit on your website. I'm really curious about the idea of the Grain Guild, and it looks like you're doing some work to try and organize or at least connect with folks that are doing like what you do, but all over the US. Can you talk a bit about that?
Yeah, well, the Honoré Growers Guild really came out of that experience with the woman who couldn't have communion bread. And I started, that's really where the original line of inquiry began, where I started to ask myself, okay, so there's communion bread or wafers on an altar. Where did that, what variety is it? Where did it grow? Who milled it? And I did this sort of vertical inquiry, and I called the wafer maker in Rhode Island, and then they gave me the name of their farmer, and then they gave me the name of their miller, and then I tracked this wafer, and it went 4,500 miles to get to, you know, a church in the Bay Area. And it just, that was sort of the lens in which I looked at bread, which is, you know, what variety is it? How is it grown? Who's growing it? How is it milled? And how is it baked? How did it get to where it is? And when you employ those questions on sort of a religious piece of bread that most people just had not really thought of, you know, communion bread in the same way that we think about when we go to the farmer's market and we meet the farmer and they tell us about the variety, or you go to these bakeries and they tell you where the wheat was grown. And so the Growers Guild is really a response to educating people about flour and wheat and how. And I trace it back to, you know, first century Palestine, and why did Jesus call himself the bread of life? Very interesting question. That sounds really strange to us today in our ears, but, you know, his hearers would have fully understood what that meant, because bread was what sustained life. It's what they ate three meals a day. It comprised probably more than 50% of their calories. So you see that field growing outside your village, and if the crops die, there's going to be famine. I mean, the immediate connection. So in that first century Palestine world, the idea of equating to the bread of life was, you know, the spiritual need and the physical need are the same. We have spiritual needs and we have physical needs. So I think that's what Jesus was saying, is I am as important to you spiritually as bread is to you physically.
Gotcha.
And it would have been completely understandable. And I think people in the church really, I think it's fascinating because there's so many environmentalists in churches and in religious organizations, and equipping them with that knowledge and information. And then when they taste the bread, and it actually tastes amazing. So that's the Growers Guild, is connecting these different religious organizations.
Gotcha. Yeah. I don't know. I'm just loving the connection that you're making between sort of the hard physical work that you're doing and the education. It's in addition to education, I think it's just more that opening people's eyes up to something that's been fundamental to them for all of history. And you know, maybe we don't think about it anymore, and we need to think about it a lot more. And so I love that. So then it's one thing to teach people something that they didn't know, and it's a whole other thing to sort of reawaken something that was inside of them. And I think you're doing a bit of both of that.
Yeah, and what's inside of us, I think, is that regenerative capacity that is the living world. And what we know biologically in the material world that's true is that everything is interconnected.
Yep.
But the same thing is true spiritually. And there's something about connecting with the land and seeing the wheat growing on this soil and seeing the water that's being used there. And all of a sudden it creates this tangible picture of what interconnection looks like, and that we're a part of that. And so awakening that's in every human being, and really all the ancient religions were founded in terms of, you know, a relationship with the land. And probably the most beautiful ones, in my opinion, are the indigenous communities and their rituals and stories around our relationship with the land.
I'm so glad you mentioned that, because I was just about to say this. It reminds me so much of the what I'm learning from Indigenous elders here on Vancouver Island, and the interconnectedness of everything. You know, that we have there's a wildflower that grows here called camas that has been traditionally harvested and for the tubers and that kind of thing, and it blooms every spring. And we're relatively new out on the island. We've only been here 3 years. And so the first year, it's like, oh, this is beautiful. You know, on these wildflowers, they're so beautiful. And then you start learning that for thousands of years, that's a very important harvest, and it nourished the indigenous folks here for millennia. And yet they still thrive because, you know, you don't harvest them all, and you don't eat them all, and it ebbs and flows and stuff, right? And that point is like, well, we're connected with what's growing here, and we're connected with the land that we live on. And what I've been thinking a lot about lately is that it's only been like 150 years that's kind of gone away. Like I'm reading a history of Scotland, and it's, you know, it's from about 1850s. Peak Industrial Revolution, which was also the time that Vancouver Island was settled by Europeans. It's only been that long. And it's the last 150 years has been a completely upside down world compared to how we all lived before. And so a lot of this, I'm going to get a little too woo-woo here for some folks maybe, but just a lot of the work that you're doing, which I've kind of known about this, the kinds of things that you're doing for a lot of years, but I haven't really appreciated it as deeply as until just recently, you know, talking to folks like you and what you're trying to do. And it's remarkable. I'm really excited for what you're doing and the work that you're pushing forward, for sure.
Thank you. I think using your example of camas, as a people close to the land, existence, feeding oneself, comes paramount, and all these rituals, and that's where culture really comes in. And then therefore, you know, these stories get passed down, the arts get passed down, and the values. So the values are, okay, we can't harvest every last one of them. We have to look towards future resilience and regeneration and propagation. We should not waste. You know, these values that I think are so present when you're really connected to the land versus if you're working in a convenience culture, it's so easy not to finish your hamburger and throw it away because you're not hungry anymore. And so one culture really breeds these practices, I think, that are not really life-giving at the end of the day. And these indigenous connected to the land practices really are life-giving, and not just to humanity, to the whole living world.
And also, I'm sure the farmers that you work with, and especially talking about regenerative farming practices and that kind of thing, are going to be right there as well, right? You know, I really think that's the next wave of this, is just to say, like in the simplest form, you know, you're growing your first plot of harumi or harani, and then you've got to hold some back for the next year, and you've got to hold some back, and you have to build it out. And then the next wave is saying, and also we have to find other things to grow here for the next time we plant harani, and so on. And I think there's going to be I'm hopeful that there's going to be an awful lot of advances or relearnings perhaps of that.
Yeah, I think relearning is exactly relearning, because really regenerative organic practices are indigenous practices.
Yeah, sure, absolutely. Thanks for doing this. Did I miss anything big? Is there anything that you were hoping we talked about that I didn't lead towards?
I think the only thing that we really didn't talk about is sort of the story, if you're interested in hearing it, about Harani.
Oh, yes, please. Sure.
And the Masada Fortress. So Steve Lyon is the chief wheat breeder and farmer at Washington State Bread Lab. And he really appreciates what Honoré Farm and Mill is doing. And he chose that grain specifically for us because of its provenance. And so it came from this fortress called Masada, which is this 1,000-foot cliff in the Judean desert that looks over the Dead Sea. And there's only one way up, which is something called the Snake Path. And this happened at a time in history when, the Jews were sort of uprising against Rome and excessive taxation, unwanted imperialism. The temple had been toppled 3 years before in 70 CE. And so this group of Jews from Jerusalem made their way to Masada, which was actually an old imperial palace that King Herod, a previous older King Herod in like 30 BCE, had built this amazing palace on the top of this cliff that had like mosaics and baths and cisterns and orchards and fields. And he had put a lot of food there to store. And apparently, which is, it's so interesting. You think about Palestine, Israel, Palestine, Egypt is right on the border there. And apparently that King Herod was really afraid of Cleopatra.
Oh, okay.
So he wanted a place to escape. And since it was so hard to get up there, he built his palace up there. And so then when it was abandoned in 73 and the Sakari Jews left Jerusalem and went to Masada and camped out, there were about 1,000 men, women, and children there. But Rome sent this huge legion of soldiers, General Silva, to go and destroy the Sicaris. And they spent 2 months basically building a ramp to get up. And so up on top of the cliff, the Sicaris are looking down and seeing their fate was sort of imminent. And so what they decided to do was they took all of the food stores that Herod had put up and maybe some that they had brought as well, and they put it all in one storehouse and they burned it.
Oh, wow.
And sort of the rocks from the walls fell in and the wood timbers, the ash fell on top of it and basically covered it. And they, sort of out of, I think, spiritual independence and physical independence, they took their own lives because they didn't want to be taken by General Silva and the Romans. So that really remained untouched until the 60s when a famous Jewish archaeologist named Yigal Yedan did an archaeological dig and found all this food. And I was going to read you one of the quotes. So we know about this through a first century historian called Josephus.
Okay.
And he wrote this. So it was 73, 74-ish when Masada, it was over the winter, that it was that the Sicarii lived there. And then in 75, Josephus wrote, "Wheat in plenty was laid up, ample for the needs of the beleaguered for a long time, and wine and oil in abundance, as well as all sorts of pulses and dates heaped up together." And sure enough, I mean, I have Yedalia Den's book that he describes what it was like to sort through the remains, and it's exactly what he found.
Oh, all wow. Those foods.
And because they were basically preserved and did not oxidize, they were actually never consumed by the fire. They were just covered. And we know that they found a date that still had date flesh on it.
Oh, wow.
And that date has been grown by some Israeli women scientists. So I'm sort of eager to know, like, so the wheat that we got from Steve Lyon, he got from the USDA Seed Bank. And I've called and talked with the chief scientist there numerous times. And, you know, every seed in the seed bank has something called a passport data. And it tells where that seed came from, who presented it to the seed bank, when, where, and when. And some of it is longer, gives you more history. This, we just know ours came from in 1972 from Amman, Jordan, which is not far from Masada. But I'm kind of curious, from 1972 to the year 73 CE, there's a long time there. Like, how are they connected? And I do know that Harani is growing in at least six villages in Palestine today. So I would love to go back there and meet the farmers and learn more of the distinctions and just hear more of the stories. So that's sort of one of the really amazing things about Harani. And then the fact that it just tastes so incredible. So incredible.
So cool. Awesome. Gives you something to think about every time you bake with some of that flour, that's for sure.
Like, there's exactly. And here's a question I have for anyone that's listening. If anyone else knows people that are growing Harani, I would love to meet them.
Well, and there's a fellow that I talked to in Lebanon that I'll put you in contact with. He's an American fellow, but he's over there, and he was baking in Beirut and also trying to start a farm out there. Okay, like, I know Lebanon isn't Palestine, but it's like, he might, you know, somebody might know somebody might know somebody.
Absolutely.
Get you in there. You know, it's closer than Vancouver Island. Anyways, you know.
So, well, to the story of Harani, it is.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly. Oh, so cool. Well, thanks for taking the time to do this. And I'm thrilled to hear the story and to hear what you're doing and sort of where you're headed with the farm and the mill and the care farm and all of that.
Well, thank you. Thanks for your interest.
Absolutely. Wow. Well, that was such a neat talk. You know, it was a bit of a challenge for me, I have to say, because it's fascinating the work that they're doing. And I realized at a couple of points throughout the conversation that, I'm assuming too much. I think I have a different picture of what they're doing than what they're actually doing. And so we kind of got back around to that. And it's really weird because a lot of it has to do with me getting my head around how small these plots of land are that they're slowly year over year expanding to grow out this heritage grain. Because I grew up near a farm. My grandparents farmed in Saskatchewan, and it was a small farm. Like, it was it was less than a section of land. And so if a quarter section being 160 acres, so what's that? 640 acres. By today's standards, that is a tiny farm. That is a little farm. You know, one farmer kind of manages the whole thing. Get some friends to help out, maybe. But what they're doing right now at Honoré is much, much smaller than that. So this whole idea of we're going to schedule harvest day in advance and we're going to get people out from the city to be part of a harvest and that is totally foreign to me. And so when she was talking about, you know, well, we hope it holds out to the weekend because there's rain forecast and this kind of thing. I'm like, oh my God, get that off the field. You know, you got to go now. But it's a different thing that they're doing. And that educational aspect of it is extremely important. So it was nice. And I hope that came across because it took me a while because I was off on my own thinking instead of getting my head around what they're actually doing there, which I think is really impressive. You know, already talked about the Halloumi versus Harani thing. I'm sorry about that. The other one that was getting me the whole time was the folks at Washington Bread Labs, because I went to a seminar with the Washington State Bread Lab folks, and it was run by Stephen Jones. And Elizabeth was always talking about Stephen Lyon that gave her these seeds. And I'm like, have I got the name wrong? Did I get that wrong? Or did I see Stephen Lyon? And so I did some digging after the call. And no, there's actually two people. It's two different people. There's a Stephen Lyon and a Stephen Jones. And I was glad I did. I was glad I just adapted. Oh my God. I feel so bad because it was like every time she said Stephen Lyon, I'm thinking, is that right? Am I wrong? Did I mess up his name in past podcasts? But it's two different people that are both at Washington State Bread Lab. So I'm 99.9% positive we're talking about the same bread lab. It's just two different Stevens. And hey, we all need more Stevens. So that's good. So yeah, so it was a really good talk. It was very interesting to me to hear the story of this grain. And that story behind it makes it kind of special, makes it really interesting. Sounds like it tastes amazing as well. Wouldn't mind getting my hands on some of that flour myself. But we'll leave it for the folks in California for now. And maybe one day, if I'm out that way, I'll get to try some. But I think that's really the point of this. And what I've been learning about grains, and especially heritage grains and these specific varieties, is that the goal isn't grow it out in California and then one day I'll see it growing on Vancouver Island. It's grow it out in California, have it be awesome in California, and we'll grow something different and awesome on Vancouver Island, unique to the growing conditions here. And it'll be completely different, perhaps, in terms of flavor and baking quality, but equally amazing out here. And the same for the folks in the center of the continent, folks over in Europe, folks in the Middle East, wherever you happen to live, that you're growing the grains that are most suitable for where you live and will feed the people where you live. So that was neat. And I'm glad we went there and talked about that on this chat. So I hope you enjoyed the conversation. I really enjoyed having it. I enjoy sharing it with you. It's nice to be back sharing talks with you. Have another one next week that is going to be completely different again. And I'm excited to share that with you too. So if you enjoyed the show this week, I'd love to hear from you. Send me a note, if you will, Mark with a K at riseuppod.com. Head over to riseuppod.com. There are all the shows there. You can listen to all of them, over 170 episodes. They're all there for you. There's even a handy dandy support the show button if you are so inclined to help support the show. Costs real money to keep this going. I'm grateful for the opportunity to share it with you, but every bit helps to keep things running. So if you want to support us, go ahead, click that big blue support the show button. Thanks so much. Until next week, work hard, bake lots, stay cool if it's still hot summer where you are, and happy baking. Bye-bye.